It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
The Pope?
I haven't been yet.
Yeah, but, you know, prophetically, tell me how it's going to be.
I'm not talking about the Pope. I'm not seeing the Pope. We're going to look at his home.
You're going to see
home of the Pope. Administrative enclave of our dear brothers of the Roman Catholic faith.
What's an enclave?
So, I made it up. It's where you hide. Isn't this where you bury bones? No, that's something else. No, I haven't been yet. We're recording this 3 weeks early, which I guess you're letting
everybody know. Our summer's like going all over the place. We're almost done with our summer.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that could be true. We're getting very close to being done with summer.
Do you like June gloom?
Yeah, actually, I do. So it's a sunny day today. I don't like it. I guess
I don't like it. Warning. Do not go outside.
It's coming back tomorrow. It's coming back tomorrow.
So. I don't like June gloom.
Yeah, you and my wife. She complains all the time. Actually, what's the matter with it? You get sun here 350 days a year. Give me 15 foggy ones. It's okay. But people don't.
Right.
What do you want to do today that you couldn't do if it's sunny?
You know, I'm not really thinking that. I just appreciate the bluer sky. I like blue sky. Don't you like blue sky?
I like blue sky if there's no sun in it.
I don't get that.
Well, the blue's prettier than gray. Absolutely. But the sun burns, it's hot, and then, you know, we were playing golf last week, and we were playing in the morning in the fog, and I'm going, isn't this perfect golf weather? And it is. You don't have the sun beating down on you.
And you golf all that way.
It's nice and cool. No, it's not that foggy. No, that's not that foggy, sir.
I played in Scotland where when you hit your ball, you have no idea where it goes.
Well, I played in the Central Valley, California. When they get the Thule fog, you can drive it.
Yeah.
But not down here. It's not that kind of fog. It's a high fog. So I got a question for you.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
Hot off the press.
So we often can't understand how people in the past could have owned slaves or not educated women. What do you think people will wonder about our generation from the future? That's a good question.
Why we couldn't balance our budget and live within our means?
Oh, I think, they could be a little ticked about that.
I mean, especially since we've sold most of their children.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm serious. You do look at that. We have a profoundly overspent consumer population. They're just going like, why is every nation on the planet seemingly unable to balance its checkbook and it lives on a credit card? Like somehow that's how it all works.
Because they can.
But they can't.
Well, they put off the hard decisions for some future generation is going to have to buy it off.
Which that's is why I think that future generation is going to be ticked.
Well, it's going to be the death knell of democracy, really. If democracy can't discipline itself enough to do the right thing, if it's just a matter of buying votes for favors.
The death knell of democracy. That's large.
Well, it will be. Everything goes bankrupt, then you're left with despots who take over and kill people. It's a horrible future. Another reason to be
there. You go. There's a little bit of June gloom for you, ladies and gentlemen, in July.
Yeah, it is July 3rd. It's getting to be the July 4th weekend. And again, I'm going to be out of the country on July 4th. So.
Yeah?
Yeah, I like being out of the country, I guess.
You do? You don't like July 4th?
It's noisy. Dogs get panicked. It's no fun. Now, we live far enough away from any fireworks display. But I've seen so many. I mean, you get to be 58. What firework display are you going to see? You haven't already seen it. Disneyland or... You know, 50 other places. I just, it's okay.
Oh, dude, you gotta live in the moment.
I do. And it's not firework. But here's the answer.
You don't like the ooh. So someone asked the question and they also gave the answer?
No. This question I just posed to you was asked of historian David McAuliffe, who's one of my favorite historian guys.
Oh.
He writes about the early fathers of our country and whatever. They asked him what we often can't understand how people in the past could have owned slaves and not educated girls. What do you think people will wonder about us? His answer was how we could have spent so much time watching TV. That's a great answer.
Huh.
We've become a nation of spectators, really. We'd rather watch a quote-unquote reality show than go across the street and discover what reality is going on in our neighborhood and our lives. And TV makes it easy to just camp out at home and miss the kind of things we talked about last week, growing friendships and relationships and things that really matter. I think in the long run, they are going to say, you know, not only just TV now, you've got all the media on the internet. Some studies are showing people are spending as much as 30, 40 hours a week.
See, but that's
in media.
I would almost tend to say, I don't think we're watching as much television. I know that the younger generation, they are off in a virtual space. They're not watching
television. They're gaming anymore.
Yeah, I mean, their television viewing has greatly dropped through the floor. And they're out in the gaming world where it's like, you got roving virtual, you know, gangs out there. And it's hilarious. I mean, I go
hilarious? Like, roving virtual gang.
Yeah, and shoot them up. You know, there's like black ops teams that come by, help each other, and then on the way that they shoot each other. You just go like, there is a weird dynamic of morality that's happening out there. And you just go like, gosh, where's the church in that space? Because that's where the younger generation is living.
Okay, you got an idea?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going in there.
You're going in.
I'm going in, buddy.
Going in.
I took the red pill. I got my machine gun. I'm going to go save some people.
I'm still thinking that's an escape from a greater reality.
Yeah. I don't.
Oh, okay.
Not for them.
Well,
not for them. I got two little junior black ops kids, and that is their social hangout place.
Right.
And I don't think it's an escape. That's where that's like meeting at the playground.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, it is bizarre to folks like you and I.
Yep.
And I've now recognized even I am old because I go like, huh?
So your idea is to get a white ops team in there? Is that what you're thinking?
No. But I'm not going to be the zombie team.
The zombie team.
No, I just think that is their playground. I mean, kids used to hang out at the mall. Now they hang out in virtual space. And that is where they go, and they're on Bluetooth, and they're talking to each other, and it's global. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, they're talking to each other about the virtual world. Are there friendships that are going to be more enduring than we were friends for a while, and then I shot you with my guns and moved on to a different game?
No, they're hooking up and working together. Honestly, it is becoming a place for their social dynamics. So
well, I want to see what kind of relationships come out of that. That's what I want to know.
Well, when I look at, yeah, I mean, their whole world revolves around, okay, they're at school, but when they're done, it's like, hey, meet you in Black Ops, and they're there.
Oh boy, I'm glad I missed that.
Yeah?
I got to tell you, I think I'm glad I missed it.
Yeah, you got granddaughters. They're not quite doing Black Ops yet.
Hey, did you hear they proved scientifically that people who claim to be born again have a smaller brain than people who don't?
Take one for the team. What do you mean?
Oh, man, I saw this in USA Today. Study finds brain differences based on faith. This was a study by Duke University, funded by the National Institutes of Health and the Templeton Foundation, which is a religious group foundation. And they measured, with MRIs, measured the hippocampus region. That's where hippos go to
the
college.
The hippocampus?
Yeah, that's where the hippos go
to college. I thought that was an exhibit in the zoo.
No, it says this, found an association between participants' professed religious affiliation and the physical structure of their brain. Specifically, those identified as Protestant who do not have a religious conversion or born-again experience, more common among their evangelical brethren, have a bigger hippocampus. The people who don't profess to be born again.
The people who don't profess, so their brain is swelling because their spirit's not working.
No, I say they have more gray matter to function. And you're saying because their spirit, it's a compensation for the spirit.
Yeah, it's compensating. Their brain is trying to do the work of their spirit.
Well, researchers have asked themselves why this could be true, and researchers speculate it may have something to do with the stress of belonging to a minority group, to which others have said, minority group? What are you talking about? It's 40% of the population, and it's one of the largest minority groups. But I wondered this, to be honest. If you look at the religious affiliation, and you add to life the pressures of work and family and home, and now the pressures of religious obligations, getting to church meetings and, you know, doing those kinds of things. Because it's saying stress is one of those things that proves it reduces the hippocampus. And if you have a reduced hippocampus, you're much more likely to encounter
in your
mental
health. The hippocampus? Front or back? Left or right?
You know what? I'm not a brain. Is it on Google Maps? I can find it.
But... where my hippocampus is. I have never checked out my hippocampus.
It's in the middle. That's what I'm saying. It's in the middle somewhere. It's not your frontal lobe.
So, somewhere in the softy center inside is your hippocampus.
That was interesting, though. I mean, so, I don't know
Oregon
why.
Oregon people have a smaller brain.
Smaller hippocampus. I'm not talking about brain as a total thing, but the hippocampus is smaller, which they say usually stress reduces
and
it.
And what is the function of the hippocampus? That's not like your frontal lobe.
No, it's not your frontal lobe. It's your hippocampus.
Yeah, no, but what's a hippocampus do? I mean, that's cute. It does feel like someone's taking a pot shot at believers.
Well, the Templetown Foundation was behind it, so I don't know that it would be a shot at believers. It was just a research study. They really didn't speculate on why. But the thing they go to is stress.
The headline does.
Yeah, well, that's USA Today for you. This was in Christianity Today. It said 35% of those who said religion carried over to all parts of their lives had high blood pressure, compared to 19.6% of the population who says religion doesn't carry over into their lives.
Really?
Yeah. It's physically dangerous to be a religious dude. That's my takeaway.
Believing could be dangerous to your health.
Not believing. I think the religious obligation thing is where that aims at. I don't know if that's true. That's my hypothesis.
That's your hippocampus take on it all.
Because I think I was much more stressed in the day I was trying to perform well and trying to keep up a way of living that was
not. I get that.
Yeah. So I don't know. Could be. Could be. Could not be.
Do you think you have a swollen hippocampus?
Not swollen. Normal size is what I'm going for. Okay. Hey, I just had a brain scan. I should go down and check. How was my hippocampus? But somehow
that would be a good case study. Out of the boxers, is it bigger or little?
They said it was smaller for my first 40 years and then got larger in the last 10 or 12. Maybe that's it. I have no idea. I just thought it was interesting.
But I do think, I mean, you might think it's goofy. I do think that our soul becomes... stressed out when it is trying to do functions that God really designed to happen in the realm of our spirit. I think most people are like, huh? There's a difference? I don't think most people have a real tangible, experiential reality of confidence that says, okay, this is the realm of the soul, and this is the realm of my spirit. You're looking at me strange.
No, I don't know. I don't know how to deal with those terms. You hear people define them in very, very bizarre ways. But I do think there's a very different between our mind and intellect and the spiritual nature that engages God. And that's probably what you're talking about. But yeah, I do believe that's true. And I think most of us, even religiously, have learned to live out of our brain. That's why we're worried about principles and ideas and give me an obligation to meet and I'll meet it. And we live out of our head rather than living out of our heart.
And that's why I think your hippocampus gets swollen.
Swollen is a good thing. Shrinkage. Shrinkage is the problem. Why can't you get this around your hippocampus? Must be teeny, teeny, teeny.
I don't know. I asked you where mine was. And I can't. I don't, maybe I don't have one.
This could be true.
I've been accused of worse.
We should get down and get that MRI taken care of so we'll know for sure.
There we go.
Well, we had people had some problems with the Power of Hope podcast. Said the little stereo, you and I coming in both sides of their head was a little overwhelming.
That was in the right channel, huh?
That was a mistake in production. I think you were...
It's corrected.
You might be. Yeah, it is corrected. So we won't have that problem again, hopefully. At least...
I think some people enjoyed it sitting in the middle thinking we were talking across the table.
I do think that was... It seemed to create more confusion than help, though. So, I mean, that's how I usually listen to the podcast, because we record on separate channels, so we can fix the audio if we need to on separate channels. But when we export it to stereo, as a mistake, it kind of freaked people out a little bit. So I get that.
They liked the Weeble anointing.
They did like the Weeble anointing. They liked talking about hope. I thought it was a couple of posts on the blog were how... difficult it is to find hope in long-term medical necessities, medical pain and suffering. Yeah. And I do think that's true. Although I do know people who find it there. Even, and I think my brother would have been one of those suffering with MS and finding, even though that didn't get better and didn't heal, and having certainly days of doubt and struggle and God, where are you in the midst of this? But always coming to most of his days, and lots of them lived in hope. That God was bigger than this thing, and either God would fix it here or it would make sense somehow beyond this age. And so, yeah, I think it's tough. I think it's to be in persistent pain and to be You know, this young gal whose poetry book we've been selling for the last 6 months or a year, I guess we met her, didn't meet her, but found out about her in England last year, who's 19 years old, gets this incredible disease. It's bedridden, constant pain. She's been at four or five years, something like that. And, man, my heart, we pray for her, Sarah and I. We hold her before the Lord. But I do think it's tough to live in that kind of extremity.
Do you think that everything that happens, happens for a reason?
No.
I don't think I do. Isn't that a little bizarre how there's almost a knee-jerk need to sort of define when things happen? It's like, well, why did this happen? There's like there's this insatiable search for a purpose or explanation of why this occurred.
Yeah, and if we can finally godly reason for this, then it will make sense. And I've seen parents, particularly when they have young kids die, high school kids, whatever, die in an accident, somehow how many kids come to Christ at the funeral or in the days after somehow justifies the death of their child. And I hurt for them. I think it's a very bizarre way to think. It's like we don't live in a world of tragedy. It's everything has a higher purpose and God will, you know, and so God killed my son so 10 people could come to Christ at his funeral. And I just go, see, I don't believe that stuff. That stuff's too bizarre for me.
I know. I don't know why there's that need, because I look at the unfortunate residue of some of that thinking, and I end up going like, golly, that does not draw me to God. If I have to somehow postulate a higher purpose and I look for comfort there, I have found the God that allows for pain and meets me in the middle of it to be far more comforting. And I don't have answers as to why that happened.
Or need them.
Not when I have a. I mean, I think in the place of abandonment, I totally get that. It's like your mind gets raped with the need to somehow put some kind of anchor or parameter, or you feel just completely vulnerable. But to me, in those moments, that's where I've kind of cried out and said, "Oh God, where are you?" And when he comes, my question gets displaced to a measure.
Yeah.
And I think when I found comfort in his presence, then needing to somehow define and extrapolate the greater meaning or the... Because, I mean, I do think, you know, people who are dealing with enduring sickness, one of the things that's so challenging is when you've prayed, when you've, you know, done everything you know to do and that's still there, that's a pretty tough nut to deal with, going like, Lord, where are you in this? And I'm hurting and don't you care?
You know? Yeah.
And so I think a lot of times people in their brain is that, well, I'm going to come up with a reason that will give me some measure of comfort. I'm going like, yeah, but what does that disfigure in terms of a God? Because it's like if you make him the author of all that stuff, I end up going like, well, where's the devil? Where's sin? Where's wrongdoing? And where's the fact that we're in a broken, messed up world right now?
Yeah.
Because to me, I sort of go like, I feel better that the fact that there are things that get messed up and I can't always draw a one-to-one conclusion.
Yeah,
this happened because of that.
And that's why I love the book of Job being where it is in Scripture, because it's not, I mean, we put it in the middle of the Old Testament somewhere. It was contemporaneous with some of the latter parts of Genesis, most likely. It's somewhere even possibly before Abraham, which is what, Genesis 9, is when this Job character probably lived. I don't know when it was written, but it's referring to a pre-patriarchal day.
Some have even postulated with Moses being a... the writer of the first five books, that Job may have been written prior to all that.
May have been. And what's interesting about it is because pretty much the first five books, the Torah, is pretty much do good, get good, do bad, get bad. It sees God in the same way that Job's advisors see God. If you're suffering, you've done something to deserve this. That's how they're seeing it. And God lays it out in Job saying, see, you're missing something. If we really think Deuteronomy says, do good, do bad, get bad. So if you're suffering, obviously you've done wrong. Job is the counterpoint to that saying, mm-mm. And Jesus is really the counterpoint to that when he says, as long as you're in the world, you're going to have trouble. And you think the people that the Tower of Siloam fell on, do you think they were less righteous than the people that it missed the day it fell? And the whole idea of trying to pack our tragedy either around the, they deserved it, that's why they get it, or God has a higher purpose. If that, and I think it goes back to what we started in this podcast talking about, trying to live out of our intellect rather than living out of our heart. Our intellect, if you base God's love on the circumstances that surround me, then I have to find a purpose bigger than whatever suffering I have to somehow make sense of God still loving me, even though my child was killed in an accident. I've got to somehow justify that instead of, no, life really brutally hurts sometimes, and bad things happen to wonderful people.
And even bad people.
And the point of, yes, it happens to everybody. And the point of Job was, no, you didn't deserve this. There was an enemy in the world out wrecking havoc, and God's in the midst of the enemy wrecking havoc to redeem to himself. And even Job's own words at the end of the book are, wow, I spoke about things too wonderful for me to understand. And to me, when Elihu comes along and when God finally has at it with Job at the end of the day, what he comes away out of his heart and spirit is, my God, this is amazing, and you are great, and you are wonderful. And yeah, I don't necessarily always understand where suffering comes from, nor do I have to, nor do I have to make sense of it.
Yeah, I think that to me is a more accurate portrayal of the universe in which we find ourselves living. I don't know the planet that there is a one-to-one correlation with everything. I don't know how to write that out. And I don't really find any comfort in that, because then I end up seeing God as the author of a lot of horrible things. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense at all to me.
No, it doesn't. And it doesn't allow anybody to just grieve. Just, man, I lost my kid. I lost my husband. God, come crawl into my grief with me. It's almost a grief avoidance tactic. God, you know, five kids came to Christ, so God considered that worth it for my son to die or my daughter.
And I will find purpose so I can somehow displace my pain with it.
Exactly. Instead of, no, God's big enough to work all things together for good. So with the tragedy in our lives, is he going to crawl into there and touch a lot of people through it? Well, I hope so. I hope that's what makes sense of our tragedies. But that's not the purpose for them, nor he the author of them.
Well, yeah, I mean, I look at the fact that the beauty of that promise out of Romans is that, you know, that God will work all things together for good. Is it doesn't tell me that all things are good, which is really helpful, because there's a lot of things I look at that are not. And I can't get my brain to do the gymnastics to say, well, no, it's really good because of this. It's like, no, God is at work. That's great. He's at work for my good. That's great. The bullseye that I think that's aimed at is my transformation into the image of his son. You know, it's like, for God, you know, is at work in all things. And there's a category of people there. For those that love him and are called according to his purpose. Well, what's that purpose? That purpose is to be conformed into the image of his son. And I look at that and go like, well, what can happen to my life that God couldn't use in a way of transforming me? You can transform me with blessing. You can dump a pile of suffering on me. Either way, if I'm looking to say, God, how do you displace the selfish me? God can be at work to transform me. That's comforting. That means nothing can hit me that he cannot do something with.
Yeah, he's not bigger than, which doesn't mean he's the one dumping the load on you.
No.
It doesn't have to mean that at all. We live in a pretty broken world, and it's just stuff happens. Bad stuff, horrible stuff.
And there's some unfun people.
There's some unfun people. But is God bigger than all of that? And I think in our heads, if we're just going to try to live with him inside our intellect, then we're going to grasp at some pretty strange things to make sense of it. If we're going to live with him inside our heart as well as our head, then there's times where God just being with me at my point of grief or brokenness or whatever, without having to justify it, without having to make sense to my brain, my heart can come to rest inside of him in the midst of that thing, knowing God's bigger than this. And my life's not caught up in that thing, nor is my life caught up in my circumstances need to serve me. It's a pretty warped way to live. And it doesn't allow you to be part of whatever unfolding reality life brings to you until we get to the end of the age. And I think living inside God's presence with us in all things is the place that
gives definition to that, even if you don't get a direct answer to, which Job never gets. Job never gets, well, here's why I did this to you, because he didn't. Or here's why the enemy got to do this to you. He doesn't even get that explanation. He just comes away saying, wow, God, you are really awesome. And I'm whining about things here that I don't even understand. And I don't want to be there.
Yeah, I think when his presence comes, I mean, I know some of the most valuable times in my life have been in the midst of total confusing pain. We're just going like, how'd we get here? I mean, I can sin my way into a mess. You know, I get that. There's no real profound need for understanding there. I can find that most of the time.
Yeah.
It's the times where you're going like, gosh, I can't directly chart that one so clearly. And that's not, gee, I'm going to fake myself out and pretend to be righteous. It's more like, no, those are the really challenging moments where you're like, I don't get this. No, that wasn't in my heart. And it's like, God, where are you? I've found that if the only time I can accept comfort from him is when all of my questions are answered.
Or my life makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to find precious little comfort. And I've just so enjoyed the sense of going like, gosh, Lord, I know your presence displaces a lot of the angst of my abandonment. And when I know you're there, somehow it's better.
So you don't mean abandonment by him? Who do you mean abandonment by?
I think most of us, the way we, I think, have our emotional equations is we experience pain and we have a knee-jerk feeling of being abandoned. It's like, if God really loved me, he wouldn't let me have this. Because I'm special, right? And he's all focused about my comfort, right? We don't say it like that, but
no, we don't. Golly. I think if I'm really on it with God, he's fixing everything hurtful in my life, because I would certainly do that for me. So certainly he would.
Yeah. I mean, I think we do have that kind of little programming in there that's kind of like, well, I think I wrote that on my heart. I don't know that that was etched by him.
Or if you went through some moment of real extreme pain, abuse, molesting as a child, whatever. I mean, you do have that sense of, where was he when that was going on? I've heard that question from multiple people.
I think in the midst, I just know when our children have been little, you know, it's like when they're little toddlers and it's like, they're just squawking. And there's nothing you can do other than just hold them. And it's like, look, you've checked the diaper, they're fed, there's no air passages being blocked. I mean, it's like we've done the full checkup and life should be okay. They can still feel totally out of sorts. And the only thing I know how to do is quiet them with my love. And when that happens, that is such a beautiful moment. It's not just, oh, finally there's love. I mean, it's
not all of that.
Sure, there is. But I do remember distinctly with each kid, there's just that sense of that embrace that's not a cerebral moment. I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't know why they were freaked out. But I held them long enough to a place of peace. And there was one of those moments where I felt like God just kind of reversed that, like, hey, would you let me do that for you kind of question that I had never, it's just it never trafficked through my brain. I went, yeah, I think I will, because there's so many things I can't figure out. Do I know what's wrong? No, I'm just squawking. I don't know what's wrong. I don't feel great. Maybe I just need a good nap. But to be able to be quieted by his love, that is such a wonderful place to find. And I think that's such an available resource. But it does kind of require that we let down some of our incessant demand to know answers to all these things. I'm going like, I don't know what they are. I don't know what those answers are.
Yeah, and I think when people ask that question, why did this happen in my life? Why is my child having this disease? Why do we deal with this issue? If that's how you're going to live, I don't know that you find that place. I do think you have to lay that down enough to say, okay, God, would you make yourself known to me right here where I'm at, in the middle of all this? How do you make sense in my life? And get it out of that, it's got to make sense to my brain before I can relax with my heart, and instead live out of the heart that said, no, if I get that, some of those comforting words ever spoken to me by God were just, I'm with you in this. I'm with you. I'm here. And this is like, whoa, because sometimes you have that sense of, oh, I feel like I'm in this one by myself, and I've got to somehow figure out the best way for this to work, instead of, oh, you are here. Okay, and when my heart comes to rest there, then it's like those questions are not as big. They're still there, but they're not big and demanding. It's like, well, if I don't know. And I think that's where Job came to. We're just too wonderful for me to understand. That's where I'm. And Job asked lots of questions and made lots of demands of God in that whole struggle. And bless their hearts, his dear old counselors didn't help him at all. They just pushed him deeper into that dark place by saying, yep, obviously you've just, and now just your arrogance deserves it. And they just kept piling on the poor guy.
Where do faith and uncertainty work? How do those come together? Because I do think that, you know, the way religion has defined faith, you know, certain are the things I can't see. And I'm like, certain, certain, certain. I'm like, I don't have a whole lot of certain, but I don't feel void of faith.
I think the bigger question is, how does faith work in certainty? Where I have certainty, I don't need faith. I don't need it. If I'm certain about something and I'm certain about the way it's going to come out, I don't need faith. Where I need faith is...
But brother, that's the evidence of your faith.
Oh, I think that's a misreading of it. I think what it says is faith is the substance of the things hoped for. So I don't have what I'm hoping for. I don't even have a way to make them happen. I can't even see how to get there from here. But I have this thing in my heart that goes, I have him. And having him and having trust that God's able to work in whatever's going on in my life, that's the rest, that's the present possession of the future hope. I have faith now. That's the substance of the thing hoped for. Certainty to me is the opposite of faith. It's not the fulfillment of it. It's kind of the opposite.
So when people are focusing their hopes on a certain outcome, doesn't that often seem to be a recipe for a little bit of shipwreck?
Or a lot of shipwreck.
I'm just trying to be kind there. I do think that that's, again, that's a sort of a misnomer. It's sort of like that's, I don't know why we have this incessant need to define things according to purpose, like it had to happen for a reason. But then I think we also do a very weird dynamic in terms of that hunger for faith, that I'm sort of trusting God for my desired outcome. And I'm going like, well, why are you doing that? Because maybe you need to have a conversation to find out if that's his desired outcome.
Yeah.
Because, I'm just trusting God. It's like, well, what? That he's just going to fulfill your wish list?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because I end up going like, that's not my experience. I know what it is to trust him for my excitement too, but I don't really know that that's what he's focused on. I don't know that that's what he's working so hard to bring about.
Yeah, in the tradition I grew up in, it was very common to hear people praying, God, we're just trusting you to bring so-and-so's husband back. We're trusting you to heal this disease. We're trusting you to... And I grew up very comfortable with that as part of my prayer language. And about 10, 15 years ago, I noticed whenever I would say that, it would seem silly. And I didn't know why it seemed silly. Or I'd hear other people pray it. We're trusting you to do this. And I guess part of it was so many things that we trusted God to do never happened. So it seems like, if we're trusting him to do what I want, and here's the question I came to, is that ultimately trust? If I'm trusting him for my outcome, then it's not really trust. It's just fairy godmother time and give me what I want. And
this is my Christmas list.
Faith is my way to manipulate you to get what I want. And I hear now when people say, God, we just trust you to do this. I'm going, that's set up for so much disappointed hope. It's set up for so much of those things I've seen people pray for. We're trusting this sickness is not unto death. We're trusting this. And once in a blue moon, some of that happens. But most of the time when we're trusting God to do, and I think when Paul prays in Ephesians 3 and said, for God is able to do exceedingly and abundantly beyond anything we can ask or imagine, I think what he's saying is when your prayers are thwarted, God has something better in mind than you can see. Not how do I get God to do it my way? It's how do I get inside God's space so that I can see a larger purpose that he's doing in my life. Not the purpose of how does this get fixed, but the purpose of, as you said earlier, shaping me in his image. And the larger thing, I used to read Ephesians 3:20 thinking, well, if I ask God for a Toyota, give me a Lexus or something like that, you know, exceedingly abundantly beyond I could ask. And really it's no, when my prayers are frustrated, God has something bigger going on than I can see. And I can, and by pulling back out of my expectation and landing more firmly in who he is, I think we get a better case for that. Man, that dog is barking up a storm. Yeah. I hope it's not coming through on the podcast.
You know, I think when people say, oh, I just feel like my prayers are frustrated or I don't know how to pray, I think it's typically like, well, let's follow that out to perhaps a more dynamic translation. God isn't doing what I demanded of him.
Yeah.
And I'm going like...
Or even just hoped for. I mean, it's not even necessarily demand. It can be just the hope.
But I look at that and it's like, golly, I think prayer is a place of communion and conversation. Why is that going to be frustrated? Have a discussion. Ask. He says, come, let us reason together. I mean, there's so many different times where God's saying, hey, let's talk. You can have a will here. You can make that known. Make your request known. It didn't say, and everything shall be granted.
Yeah.
And that's where I kind of go like, even that sense of the knee-jerk need for fatalism of, well, whatever happened, it must have been God's will. And I'm like, well, how do you know that?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it was. It might have been so-and-so's will, who is really desiring to manipulate everyone else to get that outcome.
Yeah, exactly.
And everyone else kind of went, okay.
I heard someone say the other night, which I thought was interesting, if your relationship with God is all about correction or direction, you're missing 90% of what he's saying to you. That's a great statement. If it's direction or correction, then you're missing 90% of the words of affection, things God's saying to you. And I think the same is true of our prayer life, quite honestly, if we go back the other way, because about 50, 60 years ago, everybody started this prayer list thing where you keep a prayer list, which is what? Requests, and check to see how many God's doing and if you're being faithful to pray. And I would say, gosh, if your whole prayer time with God is about asking for things, you're missing 90% about what your conversation with God could really be about.
Yeah, if that was the nature of my relationship with my kids, I'd be a little irritated.
A lot irritated, certainly. You know? And when they're adults too, particularly when they don't have to be around you all the time and they only come over to see you because they want something from you. They want you to fix their this or do that or whatever. I mean, I don't mind some of that. My kids coming over, Dad, what do you think of this? I enjoy helping my kids. But if that were the bulk of the relationship, you're right. It would be a bit frustrating. Well,
it's not a relationship. I am a resource. And it's like, I look at the dynamics of getting to know God. And I think the more I have found myself kind of, you know, it is what it is. That's not a statement of just resigning, like, well, you know, whatever. It's more like, I don't know that I know how to manipulate all those things. There's a lot of wills involved on this planet. And I'm responsible for mine. And I can be in dialogue with God to say, what are you doing? But I don't know how it works in terms of, because I don't see him coercing everyone else to just do what works for me. And so...
You're not even coercing people to do what's best for him.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. You think he'd throw me a bone every now and then. I think when...
And he has. Yeah. God has thrown me more bones.
No, but even that, I think when we look at God like that, it's like, I don't know that we know him for him. It's like for me, some of the deepest points of enjoyment are showing up and it's like, I don't have an agenda for him. I don't have my prayer list. It's more like, hey, how are you today? Are you doing anything? I mean,
yeah. And honestly, I truth in packaging laws and all that. When I have that kind of time with God, hey, God, what are you doing today? I don't get, well, here's what I'm doing, A, B, C, and D. I don't. I mean, these conversations with God, I don't think happen when I sit down and have a moment. I think it's an ongoing. There's things I hold before God that I unresolved in my life. And there's things God breathes into that at various moments of my day. But it's not, I don't have a, you know, what are you doing today, God? Well, I'm going to go out and play a round of golf. What are you going to do? Well, I'm going to join you if that's what you're doing. I think people get really false ideas of what that conversation looks like. There are times when God when God drops his stuff in my heart, when God speaks to me and there's suddenly a thought running around in my head that wasn't there before, it is sometimes come in response to a prayer. It often comes 4 or 5 hours removed from that prayer, just in a conversation or driving down the road. And all of a sudden, this random thought's there that was part of what I was talking about with God, maybe even 3 months ago, that finally begins to clarify and make sense. So this is not a conversation, this little tit for tat back and forth. It's a lifestyle of living in that communion and having time with him and listening to him through the whole of our life, not just at my quiet time.
Yeah, but I don't disagree.
But. I hear a but.
Yeah, there is. I think there's, I have found a place at times, not at my, you know, bellhop choosing. Like, oh God, let's just have a conversation. So I'm going to do my part. You need to do your part. And, but I have found an enjoyment of being able to come and spend time with him in a known felt way that is sort of free from the agenda of, Lord, you must do this. Those have been some of the more deeply satisfying. I mean, I remember, you know, like my little kids, when they're just hanging out, they're just curious about life. It's like, do they need to know why the sky is blue? No, but they're just curious. And some of those are just marvelous moments. And I think I have sought to restore some of that childlike wonder of just going like, Lord, what do you think about that? And I'll be honest, sometimes I get a sense of what he does.
I agree. And I think that happens with some wonderfulness. But I think, yeah, what I was just trying to say is that's not how it works every day.
No,
it just doesn't.
No.
And when people think that, I think they get disillusioned because it doesn't work that way for them.
No, but if there was something I would want to encourage people to do is, I think there's a wealth of relationship to be found, to be discovered, to be enjoyed, that is going to God simply because God is a worthy end to enjoy in and of himself, not because he's a tool to get certain things done. And I think that I think we've missed that. I don't remember anywhere in church that I was sort of, we're all too busy doing something. And God's the means by which we get that done. At least that was my stream of upbringing.
Yeah, and I think that's true for some. And it's also just that, you know, it wasn't that God wanted to be that real to each of us. And I did get some of that growing up. Some of the places we were at in the early days of Charismatic Renewal, it was more God wants to make himself known to you. But I think you're right. For the most part, we get used to, like we started this thing, living out of our brain, doing what I'm supposed to do. It's just clear in Scripture. Just go do what Scripture says are all ways that undermine the relationship that God really wants to have with each of us.
Thank you for traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com,